KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Our in-depth guest today, Wendy Willis, has arrived. She's the author of the new essay collection, These Are Strange Times, My Dear, Field Notes from the Republic from Counterpoint Press. Wendy is a Portland-based writer, poet, and lawyer. She's published two books of poetry, and her work has appeared in the New England Review, Oregon Humanities, Poetry Northwest, The Rumpus, and Zizova. I love saying Zizova. Wendy's been awarded the 2017 Dorothy Brunsman Poetry Prize, and she's a 2019 Oregon Book Awards finalist in the poetry category for her book, A Long Late Pledge. In her role as activist, Wendy's executive director of Deliberative Democracy Consortium and the founder and director of Oregon's Kitchen Table. She'll be reading tonight from These Are Strange Times, My Dear, at Powell's on Hawthorne at 7:30 p.m. Should also mention Wendy's married to celebrated Oregon poet David Byspiel, who will be launching his new book of poems, Republic Cafe, next Monday, February 21st, also at Powell's on Hawthorne. Wendy, thanks for coming in. I know you had some trouble with the weather and parking around here.
Hi, thanks for having me, Ken. It would have been faster to walk.
Or if those scooters were still around, yeah. You know? They'll come back, I think.
Thank you.
Well, I apologize for that long intro, but you're incredibly productive as an essayist, poet, activist, and you're the mother of two daughters, and I heard you have a mean jump shot. You must be exhausted.
Well, you know, this is what we all do, right? This is the Portland
Not
way.
Not me. I sleep most of the day. Now, you earned your law degree at Georgetown Law Center, and you have an MFA in poetry from Pacific Lutheran University. That might seem an odd pairing, though not all that unique for poets. T.S. Eliot was a bank clerk. Wallace Stevens was an insurance executive. William Carlos Williams was a doctor, practicing doctor. What were your reasons for combining poetry and the law? How do you see them combined?
I guess I think we just are who we are when we show up, right? And, you know, you mentioned Wallace Stevens, who was an insurance executive, but he was also a lawyer. And it feels to me like, you know, law is somewhat of a literary experience where you look hard at words, you're living in a world of words. And so it's not, to me, those things sort of intertwine themselves. Even though I'm not actively practicing law right now, it feels like the world of words is alive in all of those endeavors.
Yeah, I read in one of your print interviews, you were talking to another law student or a person who graduated law school and talking about how deadening some of the legal writing could be. And you even taught it for a time.
I did. Although there's some amazing writing in Supreme Court opinions. And I think, you know, over time, it's become more and more formulaic. But there, you know, you think even Supreme Court justices who I didn't necessarily agree with are some really fabulous writers.
Now, you were at KBOO last week recording the show Poetry and Everything with host Judith Arcana. That will air, KBOO listeners, on Monday, February 25th at 10 p.m. I'm assuming you focused on your two books of poetry in that interview. These Are Strange Times, My Dear, though, is your first collection of essays?
That's right.
And what goes into the decision to write an essay as opposed to a poem? What can you express in an essay you can't express in a poem, and I guess vice versa?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And there's one poem that's a sort of a companion to an essay in the last book of poems I published about Watergate, and I realized it was the telling of the story of me learning about Watergate. And the poem was very, it was from a child's point of view. So I learned about Watergate in the front seat of my mother's car, because you could do that then.
Oh, and that was listening to the news on the radio.
Yeah, listening to the radio.
1973 or so?
Yes. And so I was listening to it, and I realized that in the poem, the kind of jumps that a child's mind made was just very, it was very suited for that. Where in an essay, you sort of had to make, you know, eventually had to make sense of why it mattered to me.
The essays in the book, I should mention they were written at various times. They were published in several journals before they were collected in the book. Did you see a common theme? Did you just collect pretty much all your essays? What was the selection process like to put the book together?
Yeah, that's there are published essays that are not in the book. And I would say about a third of the essays have not been published up to now. And I think I was starting to realize that I was really interested in this arc of how does one define oneself as a citizen? That was really the question. And that some of the essays that I'd written were really kind of circling around that question. And that some of the other essays weren't. And so that's sort of how the decision-making process happened. In my imagination, the title of the book was called Becoming Citizen. So the so the question is, you know, what did that take for me? And what does it take for all of us, right? To think we have very well identified, we have roles that as parents, we have roles as workers, we have roles as consumers, all these things that society tells us how to be. But, you know, our individual identities as citizens are not necessarily set up for us. And so that's what I was really interested in.
And I read in a previous interview, you purposely use the word republic here. The subtitle of the book is Field Notes from the Republic, rather than from the nation, the country, the United States.
Yeah.
What was the reasoning for that?
I mean, I love the word republic. It's such a great word. But I also think some of it is writing from west, in some ways, writing from west to east, because if you're writing west, you should be writing in Japanese or Chinese or something. And so there's this way in which those of us who are writing in the West are always writing field notes, essentially, because the American identity is so heavily weighted to the East Coast. So I think in some ways it's always this sense of, let me tell you what's happening here. but I also think republic is aspirational, right? Like that we should be better than we are, and that we have a sense of what a republic, you know, what a constitutional republic should be. And so I like the idea that we're holding ourselves to some standard.
I've often heard, I hear it a lot now, especially given the last election where it was decided in the Electoral College and not by popular vote, that we're not a democracy, we're a republic.
Yeah.
Are those two distant foreign concepts? It seems to me we are a republic with a democracy. I don't really see the exclusion between those.
I don't either. That conversation, though, I'm in that conversation sometimes. I don't find it all that interesting, because I think, as you say, even if we say, okay, fine, we're a republic, that we aspire to have democratic practices and a democratic culture. And so, you know, regardless of what our formal structures are, there is no question that we at least aspire to holding ourselves to this idea that the citizen voice matters. And when I say citizen, I love the word citizen, not as a legal matter and not as a whether you have legal status in some way, but rather as a way of saying this is the way that we get to be in community. This is the way we get to be in public.
So it's not really just the privileges that go with being a citizen, like voting and certain rights in the bill. Well, you have your own Bill of Rights in the book and in one of the essays, a Gnostic Bill of Rights. But it's also the responsibilities we have as citizens.
Right. I think that's right. And I think some of the privileges are legally bestowed, but some of the privileges are we bestow them to one to another, right? That we make decisions in our own communities about how we're going to live together. And so that those are both privileges and rights, and we're granting them to each other.
Now, I talked about the subtitle of the book, of course, the use of the word republic there, Field Notes from the Republic. The book title itself, These Are Strange Times, My Dear, where does that come from?
That comes from a poem that I heard read in Persian, actually, at Alcatraz. This poet, Ahmad Shamlu, who I guess is a very famous poet in Iran, read this poem into the cell at Alcatraz. So Ai Weiwei did a big exhibit there, and you know, you would walk into cell and you'd hear Letter from a Birmingham Jail, or you'd hear Pussy Riot. There were all these people who had been incarcerated, and you could hear their voices in their own languages. And I was just so taken with this poem, even though I couldn't understand what was being said. And he had a beautiful voice, and I think he had passed away by then. And so then I went out into the hall where it was written down, and I copied it into my notebook in English, in the translation in English.
Would you read that for? I just love the poem. You have an excerpt here in the title essay, I guess. These Are Strange Times, My Dear.
Yeah, I love this poem, and this is just an excerpt of the poem, and you can get it online, actually. So if people want to read it, they should read the whole thing because it's so incredible. And the first line is the title of the poem, In This Dead-End Street. In this dead-end street, they smell your breath, lest, God forbid, you said, I love you. They sniff at your heart. These are strange times, my dear. And they flog love by the side of the road at the barrier. Love must be hidden at home in the closet. In this crooked dead-end street, twisted with cold, they fuel their bonfire with poems and songs. Danger, don't dare think, these are strange times, my dear. The knock on the door in the night is someone who's come to snuff out the light.
Oh, my. That's kind of frightening.
Yeah.
And this was written, Ahmad Shamlou, so he was imprisoned?
He was. I don't know that the poem was written while he was imprisoned, but mm-hmm. He was one of the most well-known poets in Iran, and he was imprisoned.
And dissident.
And dissident, that's right, and was imprisoned off and on throughout his life.
Now let's talk about another well-known figure who plays a big part in the book. This is Václav Havel, the Czech writer, activist. Also, he was president of the country, wasn't he? He got elected. Now there's one essay in particular devoted to him, though I think his influence you feel throughout the book. The essay is called An All or Nothing Gamble. I wonder if you could talk about Havel's influence on the book, These Are Strange Times, My Dear, and on your other work.
I mean, Havel's a sort of a natural patron saint for me because he's both writer and activist and writer and democratic thinker. And so, oddly, I actually traveled through Czechoslovakia in the fall and the winter of 1989, not having any idea what was about to happen and just sort of by happenstance as a very young person. And so Havel was someone I really followed. And of course, he became well known worldwide when he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And he wrote an essay in the 1970s that became really famous and was passed hand to hand throughout the sort of the Soviet bloc called The Power of the Powerless. And what his thesis in this essay was how you take power away from totalitarians and tyrants is by what he calls living in truth. Which, of course, right now is a really interesting question, right? What's true and what's
with
not
fake
true?
Fake news, right? Yeah. Yes, and we get our truth from different sources.
Yeah, but his take was it was an internal truth. So to him, it meant doing the thing that you're most compelled to do. And it could be writing poems or essays or plays, in his case, because he was a playwright.
So living your own truth.
Right.
Bringing out who you really are
and
expressing
being,
that.
And being clear about it. Mm-hmm. And the example he uses is a greengrocer who, he says, the greengrocer goes out and puts up the sign that says "Workers of the World Unite," regardless of whether he ever thinks about the greengrocer. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether he ever thinks about the workers of the world. And the moment the greengrocer decides, I don't care about the workers of the world, I care about radishes, and takes the sign down, that destabilizes totalitarians because they expect you to just fall in line both internally and externally.
Well, in your own personal truth, you play several roles. Again, I read in a previous interview, you're a Gemini, and you take that very seriously, kind of.
I live by it.
Yes, a split personality in many respects.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's true of most of us, right? I mean, I think we've become pretty clear about defining our identities in really particular ways. But if we drill down to really know people and really talk with them and listen to them, that most everyone we know has many, many identities.
As you say in the title of the book, These Are Strange Times, My Dear, and we know it's from the poem. For many of us, these are also depressing times. What would you say to someone who's feeling a sense of hopelessness about the state of our country, our republic, mm-hmm. under the current administration?
Yeah, I think that's a great question because I feel that same feeling.
Is there an answer? I'd love to know.
Well,
I'm among them.
I do think there are answers. I mean, I think one of the answers is to say, I don't know if you read Nick Kristof's piece in the Times right at the end of the of 2018, but he was like, the world is the best world we've ever lived in. Childhood mortality is going down. Lifespan is going up around the world. Hunger has gone down. Education's gone up. Literacy's gone up. So in a way, if we think about the world, more people are living in a better world than has ever been true on the planet. And one of the things that one of the big measures of the world is extreme poverty. And it used to be most of the world lived in extreme poverty. Most everyone lived in extreme poverty. And now it's 11%, which is still too many, but it's many fewer than there used to be. So I think we have a long ways to go for sure. And we have to be vigilant because it doesn't mean that just because we're here, we will stay here. But on the other hand, if you think, okay, there's a lot of things going right, how do we feed those things?
And I think you had a quote again in another interview that as hopeless as things seem in the moment, they don't go on forever. One thing you just mentioned, I remember back in the Nixon days, and I would say Trump is worse, but he can't get away with as much as apparently Nixon did. I mean, they were killing kids in the street during Nixon. The National Guard killed four people at Kent State. There were people getting their heads bashed in. That's not going on now. It's not to say it may not be going on tomorrow or in a week or so, but things have been worse in this country.
And if you think about the fact that we had a civil war, that really the future of the country was incredibly uncertain. One of the things that President Obama, you know, always says is it's disrespectful to our ancestors, to the, you know, the civil rights ancestors, to say that things are worse than they've ever been, because it's not true.
Right. Certainly for people like Obama's ancestors, they're living in slavery.
Yes.
So things are a little better now.
Yeah.
Now, as we mentioned in the intro, in addition to your writing, you're executive director of Deliberative Democracy Consortium and the founder director of Oregon's Kitchen Table. I wonder if you can tell us, Wendy, a little bit about your roles in those organizations and what the organization's mission is.
Yeah, of course. So thank you for asking about that. Oregon's Kitchen Table is in the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University. And the goal is really to get Oregonians' voices into public decision making. So we work with decision making bodies around the state, from state government down to, you know, counties and local governments, who are wanting to get to work with members of the public to hear what they think about, like, super detailed, gritty decision making. So it can be anything from a public budget to, you know, we've worked with people on water planning. And we look at we sort of look at the census data of a place, and we say, what are the communities that aren't heard very often in these decision making? And then we come up with strategies to help those voices come into the public decision making, whether they're voters or citizens or just got here yesterday.
And that's more local?
It's all state. It's in the state of Oregon,
where Deliberative Democracy Consortium is national.
That's right. And it's, you know, technically global, although mostly North American. But it's, that really is focused on what are the cutting edge practices in deliberative democracy around the world. And one of the things that's sort of heartening is, you know, even though we talk about a sort of democratic recession, there are all these practices happening in Australia and in Ireland and in Africa and many in Uganda. There's a great bunch of practices where the public voice is coming into decision making.
Can you give us some examples of that, again, to help us with our hopelessness
yeah.
here?
Well, I think a great example is Ireland. So Ireland just recently amended its constitution, which you probably heard about, because it included legalizing some forms of abortion and gay marriage.
And which is very unusual for Ireland, because it's basically a Catholic country,
right.
Very fundamentalist.
And
we didn't
know that they would ever be able to do that. And they did it through a really detailed public process where they had both a constitutional convention that included appointed people that were appointed by the parties, but also people who were randomly selected from off the street to come and get involved in the constitutional convention. And then following that, they did a citizen assembly where they had 100 randomly selected Irish citizens that came and studied the constitution for, I think it was 8 days over the course of a year, and then made recommendations on these constitutional amendments to their fellow voters. And then it went out to the vote. So people from Ireland keep writing these stories about Brexit, right? And saying, hey, you know, we've got some ideas for you on how you might involve the public in a really meaningful way.
And now, Wendy, where can our listeners find out more information about These Are Strange Times, My Dear, and your upcoming events, including tonight's reading at Powell's on Hawthorne? That's at 7:30, I should mention.
Yes, there's a Powell's reading tonight, and then there are readings, in variety of places around the state of Oregon and in Washington over the next few weeks. And if you go to my website, I think it's pretty up-to-date, wendyraywillis.com. Ray is RAE, and there are some of the readings and upcoming events at that point.
Well, Wendy, thanks so much for joining us in KVU. I'm sorry for the hassles with the weather and the parking here.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for your patience.
We've been talking with Wendy Willis, author of the new essay collection, These Are Strange Times, My Dear, Field Notes from the Republic from Counterpoint Press. Wendy will be reading at Powell's on Hawthorne tonight. You can catch her there at 7:30. There's time, and she'll be a guest on KBOO's Poetry and Everything show, hosted by Judith Arcana, on Monday, February 25th at 10 p.m. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.